Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to Colorado Business Digest, narrated by Michael Hesser, with resources including Colorado Biz, Denver Gazette, and the Leeds School of Business. Our first article is titled, Louisville Firm Acquires Class A Office Tower in Washington, D.C. 11-story building in prime location goes for $29.3 million, dated January 5, 2025. Louisville-based real estate investment firm Real Capital Solutions has acquired an 11-story Class A office building in Washington, D.C.'s East End submarket for $29.3 million, the firm announced December 23. This acquisition represents our strategic approach to invest in high-quality office assets in a prime location at a significant discount to replacement cost, said Marcel Arsenault, chairman, CEO, and founder of RCS. In addition, it aligns with our disciplined strategy of acquiring financially distressed yet operationally strong properties. Designed by Hartman Cox Architects, the property at 1501 M Street Northwest features 178,510 rentable square feet. Recent enhancements include a $13 million investment to upgrade the lobby, restrooms, fitness center, and a three-story town hall amenity space. We see enormous potential to unlock value by building on the property's existing strengths and introducing improvements that meet today's tenant needs, said Adam Abel, Chief Acquisitions Officer of RCS. This building stands out as a well-located asset, ready to capitalize on emerging market opportunities, positioning it for long-term success. Jerry Trainer with Transwestern brokered the transaction. RCS continues to execute its nationwide investment strategy, focusing on underperforming assets that present unique opportunities for value creation. With its partners and co-investors, the company anticipates acquiring as much as $1 billion of distressed office loans and real estate across the U.S. in 2025. RCS currently owns 80 properties with more than $2.4 billion of assets under management. Our next article is titled, CES 2025 is here. What can we expect from the annual show of all things tech? More than 4,500 exhibitors across 2.5 million square feet of floor space expected in Vegas this week, dated January 6, 2025. CES, the annual trade show of all things tech, is upon us. The multi-day event, organized by the Consumer Technology Association, kicks off this week in Las Vegas, where swaths of latest gadgets and advances across industries like personal tech, transportation, healthcare, sustainability, and more are set to be on display. And, like last year, artificial intelligence is everywhere you look. CES 2024 saw more than 138,000 attendees, according to the CTA, and organizers expect to see at least that amount again for this year's show. Over 4,500 exhibitors, including 1,400 startups, are also anticipated across 2.5 million square feet of floor space this week. These are the people getting together, focusing on solving some of the world's biggest problems, and magic occurs, Gary Shapiro, CEO and Vice Chair of the CTA, told the Associated Press ahead of this week's show. Formerly known as the Consumer Electronics Show, CES brings attendees and exhibitors from around the globe, with Shapiro noting that organizers expect some 50,000 attendees to come from outside the U.S. Beyond an array of startups, big-name companies set to make appearances this year include NVIDIA, Delta Airlines, Honda, Volvo, Panasonic, and L'Oreal. There may be some increased security this year. CES 2025 arrives less than 1 week after a highly decorated Army soldier fatally shot himself in a Tesla Cybertruck packed with explosive before it burst into flames outside of President-elect Donald Trump's hotel in Las Vegas, not far from much of the trade show's planned event space. Shapiro said that organizers regularly work with officials for event safety and that modest changes were made in response to recent events, but couldn't go into further detail. The AP spoke with Shapiro about what to expect for CES 2025. The conversation has been edited for clarity and length. CES 2025 will be an exceptional leap forward in terms of innovation and technology, with a focus on a variety of themes important to the future of humanity. Over 4,000 companies will be here, on literally miles and miles of exhibit space, and they'll be showing solutions to fundamental human problems, like access to food, clean air, clean water, and mobility, as well as healthcare technology. We also have newer categories. We're seeing more technology for the disability community, for example. Products that can serve people with disabilities had a large presence last year, and we expect that to be even bigger overall this year. The show is serving humanity and using technology and innovation to fill in gaps where we need more work. Generative AI is affecting virtually every area. Just about every major exhibitor will be talking about AI in one form or another at CES this week. For businesses, the focus is more on enterprise and productivity. But for individuals, it's about personalization. We'll see exhibitors, such as PC companies, focusing on personalization and new products for the PC and laptop marketplace. And then there's AI being used in mobility, and not just in features for cars and self-driving. It's for all sorts of vehicles, including agricultural products from companies like Caterpillar and John Deere. The industry representing the companies involved welcomes government regulation. The government's job is to say that this is safe or unsafe, and so the companies know what is legal and what is not. At the same time, a big challenge is if government stops innovation, so the question is for every country to find that balance. We expect the Trump administration to take a much more pro-business approach that favors innovation, including a focus on all sorts of energy sources, which is very important. But tariffs are taxes, and we know that they are inflationary and paid for by consumers. If we go forward with the proposals that the president-elect has indicated he may put in place, there would be severe impacts on the prosperity of the U.S. It depends on how exactly these tariffs are adopted, but under some of the proposals, we estimate a range of 30 to 50% price increases for basic products like PCs, cell phones, laptops, tablets, smartwatches, and all sorts of different products that consumers get a great value on today. That means fewer people will be able to access these products. And of course, other countries may then retaliate against U.S. exports. We don't want to go in that direction. CES is always focused on safety. There's a lot of things we can talk about, but suffice to say, we work with federal, state, and local and facility officials for lots of planning. We've made some modest changes given the recent events, but we're always trying to do better. I think companies are excited to come here, and any requests we've gotten have been extremely isolated. Having top executives here, especially after COVID, is very special. People are focused on coming to Las Vegas and having this opportunity to meet face-to-face and finding the serendipity and discovery that happens when you're making these business connections in person. That's why trade shows like CES and others are such important events for the world. Our next article is titled, Blocked Nippon Steel Takeover Creates Uncertainty for U.S. Steelworkers. Japanese firm had promised to invest $2.7 billion in aging operations. Dated January 5, 2025. By blocking a Japanese company's takeover of U.S. Steel, President Joe Biden said he was protecting good jobs in the American heartland. He may be putting them at risk instead. In making its nearly $15 billion bid for the storied Pittsburgh-based steelmaker, Nippon Steel had promised to invest $2.7 billion in U.S. Steel's aging blast furnace operations in Gary, Indiana, and Pennsylvania's Mon Valley. It also vowed not to reduce production capacity in the United States over the next decade without first getting U.S. government approval. They were going to invest in the Valley, said Jason Zagai, an operating technician and vice president of the United Steelworkers Local Union at U.S. Steel Plant in the Mon Valley. They committed to 10 years of no layoffs. We won't have those commitments from anybody. Zagai and some other Mon Valley steelworkers supported the Nippon deal in defiance of the union's national leadership, which pressured the Biden administration to kill it. Losing the Nippon U.S. Steel deal will be a disaster for Pennsylvania, said Gordon Johnson, who follows U.S. Steel stock on Wall Street as founder of GLJ Research. I really don't understand. This is not in the interest of the workers. It's not in the interest of the shareholders of U.S. Steel. On Friday, Biden said he was stopping the Nippon takeover after federal regulators deadlocked on whether to approve it. Because a strongly domestically owned and operated steel industry represents an essential national security priority. Without domestic steel production and domestic steel workers, our nation is less strong and less secure. U.S. Steel stock dropped 6.5% on the news Friday. The decision, announced less than 3 weeks before the president leaves the White House, reflects a going bipartisan shift away from free trade and open investment. President-elect Donald Trump has already come out against the Nippon takeover. As president, he wrote last month on his Truth Social platform, "I will block this deal from happening. Buyer beware." In a joint statement, Nippon and U.S. Steel called Biden's decision a clear violation of due process and the law, and suggested they would sue to salvage their deal. "We are left with no choice but to take all appropriate action to protect our legal rights." U.S. Steel was founded in 1901 in a merger that involved American business titans J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie, and instantly created the largest company in the world. As the U.S. grew to world dominance in the 20th century, U.S. Steel grew with it. In 1943, at the height of the World War II manufacturing boom, U.S. Steel employed 340,000 people. But foreign competition from Japan in the 1970s and 80s, and later from China, gradually eroded U.S. Steel's position and forced it to close plants and lay off workers. The company now employs fewer than 22,000 in an industry dominated by the Chinese. The U.S. government has sought over the years to protect U.S. Steel and other American steelmakers by imposing taxes on imported steel. During his first term, Trump slapped 25% tariffs on foreign steel, and Biden kept them or converted them into import quotas. Either way, the trade barriers kept the price of American steel artificially high, giving U.S. Steel and others a financial boost. U.S. Steel is profitable and is sitting on $1.8 billion in cash, though that is down from $2.9 billion at the end of 2023. United Steelworkers President David McCall declared Friday that U.S. Steel had the financial resources to go it alone. "It can easily remain a strong and resilient company," he told reporters. But U.S. Steel has said it needs the cash from Nippon Steel to keep investing in blast furnaces like the ones in Pennsylvania and Indiana. Without the Nippon Steel transaction, U.S. Steel will largely pivot away from its blast furnace facilities, putting thousands of good-paying union jobs at risk, negatively impacting numerous communities across the locations where its facilities exist, U.S. Steel warned in September. The company also threatened to move its headquarters out of Pittsburgh. On its own, U.S. Steel seems poised to focus on newer electronic arc furnaces, such as its Big River plant in Arkansas, which can make high-quality steel products more efficiently and at lower prices compared to blast furnaces, said Josh Spores, the Pennsylvania-based head of Steel America's analysis for commodity research, CRU. "I don't know if they don't have the will, but they seem to have seen that it's a much better investment, a much better rate of return if they look to invest in an electric arc furnace rather than a blast furnace," Spores said. He noted that no steelmaker has built a blast furnace in North America for decades. One possibility is that another company will step in and make a bid for U.S. Steel. In 2023, arch rival Cleveland-Cliffs offered to buy U.S. Steel for $7 billion. U.S. Steel turned down the offer and ended up accepting nearly $15 billion all-cash offer from Nippon Steel, which is the deal that Biden nixed Friday. Perhaps, analysts say, Cleveland-Cliffs will try again. In a statement, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro warned U.S. Steel management against threatening the jobs and livelihoods of the Pennsylvanians who work at the Mon Valley Works and at U.S. Steel HQ and their families. Shapiro also said companies that put in bids to buy U.S. Steel in the future must make the same commitments to capital investment and protecting and growing Pennsylvania jobs that Nippon Steel placed on the table. Our next article is titled, Apple to pay $95 million to settle a lawsuit accusing Siri of eavesdropping. Alleged recordings shared with advertisers, lawsuit asserted. Dated January 2, 2025. Apple has agreed to pay $95 million to settle a lawsuit accusing the privacy-minded company of deploying its virtual assistant Siri to eavesdrop on people using its iPhone and other trendy devices. The proposed settlement filed Tuesday in an Oakland, California federal court would resolve a five-year-old lawsuit revolving around allegations that Apple surreptitiously activated Siri to record conversations through iPhones and other devices equipped with a virtual assistant for more than a decade. The alleged recordings occurred even when people didn't seek to activate the virtual assistant with the trigger words, "Hey Siri." Some of the recorded conversations were then shared with advertisers in an attempt to sell their products to consumers more likely to be interested in the goods and services, the lawsuit asserted. The allegations about a Snoopy Siri contradicted Apple's long-running commitment to protect the privacy of its customers, a crusade that CEO Tim Cook has often framed as a fight to preserve a fundamental human right. Apple isn't acknowledging any wrongdoing in the settlement, which still must be approved by U.S. District Court Judge Jeffrey White. Lawyers in the case have proposed scheduling a February 14 court hearing in Oakland to review the terms. If the settlement is approved, tens of millions of consumers who owned iPhones and other Apple devices from September 17, 2014 through the end of last year could file claims. Each consumer could receive up to $20 per Siri-equipped device covered in the settlement, although the payment could be reduced or increased depending on the volume of claims. Only 3% to 5% of eligible consumers are expected to file claims, according to estimates in court documents. Eligible consumers will be limited to seeking compensation on a maximum of 5 devices. The settlement represents a sliver of the $705 billion in profits that Apple has pocketed since September 2014. It's also a fraction of the roughly $1.5 billion that the lawyers representing consumers had estimated Apple could be required to pay if the company had been found violating wiretapping and other privacy laws had the case gone to trial. The attorneys who filed the lawsuit may seek up to $29.6 million from the settlement fund to cover their fees and other expenses, according to court documents. Our next article is titled, Budget Battle. State lawmakers grapple with $750 million budget deficit. Dated January 3, 2025. State lawmakers will return to Denver on January 8 for the next legislative session. The November election had minimal impacts on the overall makeup of the General Assembly. Democrats still have control of the governor's mansion, along with both chambers of the legislature, although they did lose a supermajority status with a few seats, including House District 16 in Colorado Springs, flipping from blue to red. There are likely to be several new laws being proposed in the halls of the state capitol that will have long-lasting impacts on business throughout the state. Among the lawmakers who will be debating those new policies this year is State Senate Minority Leader Senator Paul Lundeen of Monument, a Republican who represents Senate District 9, which incorporates the northwest corner of El Paso County. Small business owners, and frankly, national businesses that are invested in Colorado, are the proverbial frog in the pot that has been getting boiled by increasing the temperature a degree a year for a couple of decades under Democratic leadership. Colorado is substantially less business-friendly today than it was a decade or two decades ago, Lundeen said. In the past few years alone, there have been several programs implemented by state lawmakers that have had an impact on the bottom line for small businesses throughout the state. That includes the Paid Family Medical Leave Act and the state entering the retirement business by mandating retirement savings plans statewide and starting a state-run program if employers with 5 or more employees do not offer a private retirement savings plan. Lawmakers have also been steadily increasing the state's minimum wage over the past year, which has increased the bottom line cost for many businesses in the state. Additionally, the state has been bolstering various regulations and policies ahead of the federal clean energy program mandates, which has added to the burden on nearly every sector of the economy. Even if no wide sweeping policy is implemented this year, the state's current fiscal deficit has been driving headlines and will be felt by businesses and consumers alike. Before the next session of the General Assembly officially gavels in, the state joint budget committee began meeting in November to go through Governor Jared Polis's proposed budget, a $46 billion spending plan that proposes multiple belt-tightening moves, including widespread cuts across the state government, but still faces a nearly $750 million shortfall. We went through the COVID crisis of the federal government, which prints money for a living, pushed out to the states all sorts of funny money, and many of us Republicans stood resolute, saying, "Do not create ongoing programs with one-time federal money," Lundeen said. You know what happened. A lot of ongoing commitments. The state government expanded their headcount based on that one-time money. Concerns over one-time federal spending creating ongoing statewide programs are shared across the aisle by incoming state Senator Mark Snyder. Snyder, a Democrat from Manitou Springs, was recently elected to the state district 12 seat after spending several years in the state house. "We've been at a surplus for several years now, and a lot of that, I think, was during the pandemic, especially the federal dollars. And now we're talking billions of dollars came into Colorado, so we were now able to keep everything afloat. But eventually these bills come due, and I think that's where we are right now," Snyder said. Adding to the fiscal concerns is the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, TABOR, legislation unique to Colorado that requires having any tax increase be approved by the voters of the state. "We have this formula that says your budget can only grow by, I think, 1% plus a population factor. And when we have a downturn, that budget will be considerably smaller. And then that next year, it's not like we can recapture that loss from one year to the other. It's almost like Sisyphus trying to push that boulder up the hill. Whenever we get close to the top, it seems like we get knocked back down again and have to start over," Snyder said. State voters in 2005 opted to allow the state to take a five-year break from the TABOR ratchet down calculation, something that Snyder said he would be in favor of considering this year. Lundeen, on the other hand, said that the current TABOR ratcheting is a safeguard against overexpanding government. "In the years I've been in the General Assembly, both in the House and in the Senate, every year that I have been here, government has grown faster than the real economy of Colorado. And that is even under the protection of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. If we let the Taxpayer Bill of Rights be cut down, knocked down, or reduced in any way, the growth of the government over the real economy will expand. And that difference, that delta between the real economy growth and the state government's growth, will expand even further, which will have a diminishing, damaging effect on the real economy of Colorado. To bolster economic growth, many employers across the state are continuing to hang the proverbial help wanted sign to attract talent to the various areas of the state, including Colorado Springs. Each year, the Colorado Springs Chamber and EDC works with their membership bases to advocate the business priorities of the Pikes Peak region to elect officials in the state capital. The Chamber will continue working with both parties to advocate for business-friendly policies, said Devin Camacho, Government Affairs Director for the Colorado Springs Chamber and EDC, who also said that the Chamber will be focusing on advocating for policies to positively strengthen workforce housing and child care throughout the state, as well as ensuring good governance and a regulatory environment for conducting business in the state of Colorado and the Pikes Peak region. "The issue of promoting workforce housing has been one of the largest priorities for local lawmakers over the past few years. The main issue of contention around current laws involves construction defects when it comes to building townhomes or condominiums. Under current state law, if a construction defect is found in one unit, it can be assumed that the defect is present in all the units of development. The current law has made obtaining insurance for those projects cost prohibitive, leading to the current influx of multifamily rental units being built throughout the state. The insurance cost is more than six times greater to build for sale multifamily developments than it is to build for rent multifamily, and that is preventing the development of affordable housing. The most affordable, accessible, and attainable housing in Colorado is not being built because construction defects litigation laws invite lawsuits instead of inviting more affordable homes to be built, said Lundeen. Legislation to address this issue has been brought up every year for several years, but has yet to cross the legislative finish line and reach the governor's desk. We are expecting construction defects to come back for debate, and hopefully we can work with legislators and our fellow partners throughout the industry to ensure that some type of reform happens with construction defects so that we can get some condos and townhomes built for entry-level workforce, for seniors who are looking to downsize, and for families and individuals across the board, said Camacho. Our next article is titled, Take the Wheel. Driver-owned rideshare company takes to Colorado Springs roads. Dated January 3, 2025. A new rideshare venture was just weeks old when Sean Strain became one of its first Colorado Springs-based drivers in October. Since leaving the corporate world, where he worked for years as a financial crimes investigator, he had put 4,600 Lyft rides under his belt and developed a love of driving. So when his daughter told him about the Drivers Cooperative Colorado, he looked it up online and was intrigued by what he saw. The co-op gives 80% of fares to drivers and keeps the remaining 20%. Lyft and Uber say they give 70% of fares to drivers, but that's after they've taken out all their marketing fees, insurance fees, just fee after fee after fee, Strain said. Their transparency isn't quite what drivers would like to see. Another aspect of the co-op that appealed to Strain was that it does not have surge pricing where fares go up on busy periods. Pricing is going to be consistent for riders all the time, Strain said. Rides with the co-op are usually less expensive than they are with Uber and Lyft. A route Strain has driven a number of times for both Lyft and the co-op would cost a passenger $34 with Lyft and $25.21 with the co-op, he said. He gets just under $20 for driving that route with the co-op. With Lyft, he gets roughly $11. There's a huge difference, he said. It's night and day in favor of the co-op. The Drivers Cooperative, Colorado, officially launched September 25 after a two-year prep phase led by the Rocky Mountain Employee Ownership Center. The Denver-based incubator focuses on building employee ownership of a business, arguing that our current economy benefits too few at the expense of too many, but employee ownership is a powerful tool to change that. Min-Soon Ji, an immigrant from Korea, was the driving force behind the co-op. 2 years ago, she met a rideshare driver for one of the big two, sitting in a parking lot at Denver International Airport. She approached him, pitched the idea to him of driving for a company that he would have a stake in, and which would allow to keep more of the money he made, and invited him to a meeting of the nascent driver's co-op. Today, that driver, an immigrant from Sudan, is on the board of the driver's co-op, and G is the executive director of RMEOC. The co-op is easy to sell to drivers, partly because they're so fed up with the conditions they work under at Uber and Lyft. A study published at Science Direct in 2019 found that drivers for the two established rideshare services in Denver grossed, on average, $15.57 per hour. After expenses but before tax, they earned between $5.72 and $10.46 per hour, less than the standard minimum wage in Colorado, which was $11.10 at the time. On a ride from the airport into Denver, Uber and Lyft drivers were sometimes paid just $15, while their passengers were billed $80, according to the Shareable nonprofit, which helps communities move from inspiration to action through cooperative and solutions. The co-op is negotiating with DIA to gain access to the airports for its drivers. Once it's done that, it will start talking with Colorado Springs and Pueblo airports. Uber and Lyft drivers have also complained about unprocedural deactivations, the rideshare world's euphemism for being suspended. The big two sometimes deactivate a driver if a customer complains about them, but they often fail to get the driver's side of the story, said Abdu Ali, a driver and dispatcher for the co-op. In the 4 years that he drove for Uber, Abdullahi, who goes by the nickname Super and didn't give his last name, was deactivated 5 times. Usually it was because customers complained of a strong smell of alcohol in his car. But Abdullahi is a teetotal, he said. What they smelled was the really, really drunk passengers he'd picked up and dropped off before them. Uber did not get his side of the story when he was suspended, Abdullahi said. Uber does not list a contact on its website to allow us to verify his claim. At the co-op, complaints against drivers are reviewed by a committee, which might request a recording of the ride, said Erica Lacano, a researcher at RMEOC and the community support director at the driver's co-op. All our drivers are required to have a dash cam in their car. Drivers will be given an opportunity of a fair hearing, and the co-op will take actions accordingly, she said. The founders of the co-op had to have a Colorado law changed before they could launch the company. By changing the law, they got an annual fee that's imposed on rideshare companies cut from $100,000, which they really couldn't afford, to $16,000. Once they'd done that, they began recruiting drivers. Today, the co-op has over 4,000 drivers, and close to 15,000 riders have downloaded the app, Iacono said. It's raising funds through grants and crowdfunding to augment the 20% cut it gets from each ride, which she said was absolutely not enough to grow the business and develop technology to support the business model. It's also trying to negotiate contracts with nonprofits, churches, care providers, government agencies, and institutions. If we have those kinds of big contracts, there's more possibility that we can start breaking even and turn a profit, she said. And it's recruiting riders and drivers, particularly in Colorado Springs and Pueblo, where it had 7 and 1 drivers, respectively, as of early December. It's a chicken and egg thing, G said. If the drivers are available but there are no riders, it's going to take more time for the co-op to reach cruising speed as a business, just as it would if there were lots of riders and not enough drivers to meet demand. Our next article is titled, Space Out? Trump's re-election refuels concern over Space Command's permanent headquarters. Dated January 3, 2025. As the dust has settled following November's presidential election, one question has remained across the Pikes Peak region. Will Donald Trump once again decide to move the permanent headquarters of the U.S. Space Command from Colorado Springs to Huntsville, Alabama? The Joint Force Command is currently housed at Peterson Space Air Force Base, and is tasked with planning, executing, and integrating military space power to deter global aggression. The initial decision to relocate Space Command to Huntsville in the waning days of Trump's first term was widely believed to be a politically motivated decision. Efforts were high across the following 4 years to have President Joe Biden reverse the decision, which took place in July 2023. Colorado is the rightful home for Space Command. Our state's space and military assets are critical to America's national security, and Colorado is the best place for our service members and their families to train, live, work, and retire, United States Senator Michael Bennett wrote on social media. No matter who is in the White House, I will keep fighting for the nearly 58,000 members of Colorado's military community. As busy as Colorado's federal delegation has been to keep the Joint Force Command local, a similar effort has continued in Alabama to regain the command and have it once again move to Huntsville's Redstone Arsenal. Yet another reversal of the decision is on the table, as Trump mentioned on the campaign trail that he would make good on the promise to relocate Space Command to Huntsville. We've heard a lot of discussion, particularly since November 5, about that. I think a lot of it was speculation based off of what other people were saying. It's not off of anything specific, and we're trying to find out where all of that stands right now, said newly elected 5th Congressional District Representative Jeff Crank. Crank is entering Congress to replace longtime local Republican Representative Doug Lamborn, who was an outspoken advocate for not only the creation of Space Command, but also keeping it headquartered in Colorado Springs. There's no doubt about it. From a taxpayer standpoint, it will cost additional money to stand it up a command somewhere else. Doesn't matter where it is. I think it's billions of dollars more, and it's undeniable. The other fact that's undeniable is that it is a fully operational command in Colorado Springs. If we're at a point where we're trying to save money, why would we want to move it somewhere else? As elected officials are working to keep the command local, some in the local economy might fear what the reversal of decision once again could mean. However, Mark Stafford, CEO of Delta Solutions and Strategies, a Colorado Springs-based defense contractor, said that they don't anticipate major impacts to their local headquarters. Our job as a defense contractor is to support U.S. Space Command and their mission. We are already supporting them in multiple locations, in multiple states, so adding Huntsville would just be another location for us to support U.S. Space Command. We already have an office in Huntsville, and we already have about 16 employees there, so not a big impact, he said. Stafford said that the initial headquartering debate that took place in early 2020 has prepared Delta Solutions and Strategies to be ready and adaptable no matter what decisions are made in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of unknowns for the first few months going forward after a new administration. You can plan the best you can, making sure you have a diverse business portfolio and making sure your personnel is taken care of, but there's not much you can do until you find out the information. Right now, we're not too concerned with the new administration. There might be some great opportunities for us here in Colorado Springs and the Colorado defense community. I think, if anything, that might be a good potential for growth. Our next article is titled, Denver Clerkship Pairs Clinicians with Medical Students for a Year at a Time, dated January 7, 2025. In early October, Intermountain Health family physician Dr. Marcella Serrano has a packed schedule of patients. Many have much to discuss. The current patient has multiple conditions and a list of symptoms. Your blood pressure's looking good, Serrano tells the patient. Great job on that. The patient bursts into tears. I do everything I'm supposed to, they say, and I'm still so sick. Annalisa Ortiz, second-year medical student at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, hands the patient a tissue. Ortiz is in her second month of the school's community longitudinal integrated clerkship at the Intermountain Health Superior Clinic. Serrano reassures the patient and gives them a moment to recover. Then Ortiz listens with a stethoscope to the patient's breathing. She listens again, instructing the patient to blow out more forcefully. Outside the room, Serrano and Ortiz discuss the patient. Did you hear how that changed the sound? Serrano asks. You can hear the wheezing. We'll have to keep an eye on that. This is the first year Intermountain Health Medical Group is hosting a medical student for a clerkship. Ortiz spends 1.5 days each week for 1 year with Serrano and pediatric nurse practitioner Carrie Waddell. Where traditional clerkships revolve around intense rotations that last a few weeks, the integrated clerkship allows students to follow patients over an extended period. Historically, I've precepted family nurse practitioners during their pediatric rotations, Waddell says. Working with Annalisa not only allows me to share this joy with the next generation of clinicians, but has also helped me gain insight into the medical model of clinical training. Dr. Henry Colangelo, MPH, is a faculty member, family physician, and director of the CU School's Community Health Longitudinal Integrated Clerkship. He explains that this is a different approach to training physicians. Traditional medical education for the past century has been block rotations where medical students, typically in their third year, will rotate through all different specialties. Every 8 weeks, they move to a new area. Alternatively, the longitudinal integrated clerkship model places a student in a given field for an entire year. The model has been around internationally since the 1970s, Colangelo says, and in the United States for only about 15 years. At CU, medical students complete clerkships with health systems, federally qualified health centers, and patient-centered medical homes in rural and urban areas. Colangelo says surveys of medical students show they have improved engagement. Time and time again, the high points are always feeling part of the team, he said. They report more autonomy and hands-on experience as well. The clerkship also opens more opportunities for students to explore different specialties, which he said translates into more joy for their chosen field. The public wants to have a doctor who is engaged and understands them, Colangelo said. When we start instilling that into the practice early in their training, I hope we put doctors who will continue those ideas throughout their practice and be better doctors. Serrano welcomes the chance to have a clerkship at her clinic. Teaching the next generation of students feels like paying it forward. The people we train now are those who are going to take care of me when I'm older, she says. She was excited to have a female student who was a working understanding of Spanish. Probably 70% of the patients in the clinic are Spanish-speaking. It's also about them seeing that there are more people who look like me who are coming down the pike to provide medical care, she said. At the clinic, the next patient of the day speaks Spanish. Ortiz takes notes while Serrano and the patient banter. Everything still there? The patient asks in Spanish as Serrano listens to their lungs and heart. Yes, she answers in Spanish, but it doesn't work. Ortiz chuckles. This patient, too, has several conditions, and Ortiz may see them again before she rotates out. She's grateful for that opportunity. I didn't fully appreciate before I started how important that longitudinal aspect was, she said. I would be transitioning out already by now, so I appreciate the chance to build relationships with patients and with Kari and Serrano. I enjoy getting a glimpse of how they practice medicine, and I can see myself pulling pieces of how they practice into my own identity, Ortiz adds. This year is me discovering what kind of doctor I'm going to be. Our next article is titled, ESG Investing. Are your values truly reflected in your portfolio? Dated 12/11/2024. Investors eager to align their portfolios with sustainability goals may be in it for a surprise. Researchers studying active U.S. stock mutual funds that claim to embrace environmental, social, and governance principles found significant disparities in how these funds operate, revealing a tangled web of strategies that could leave investors questioning whether their values are truly reflected in their investments. ESG labels often mean 100 different things, said Simona Abyss, assistant professor of finance at the Leeds School of Business. Since we don't agree on what they all mean, misunderstandings can arise, even when funds are trying not to mislead investors. The researchers, including Abyss, Andrea Bufa, also an assistant professor of finance at Leeds, and Meha Sastavism, a PhD candidate at Columbia University, aim to classify ESG funds more accurately by analyzing the investment strategies stated in mutual fund prospectuses. From the vast pool of mutual funds that invest primarily in U.S. stocks and are actively managed, meaning a fund manager or team picks stocks and makes investment strategy decisions, the researchers identified funds with ESG-related strategies using a dictionary of ESG terminology. Then they read each prospectus, a document that provides details about a potential investment, manually. In a working paper describing the study, the researchers categorized the funds into three types based on what they found. Number one, exclusionary. These funds exclude certain stocks that do not align with their ethical or values-based criteria. Through screening processes, they may eliminate companies with poor labor practices, for example, or those involved in fossil fuels, tobacco, and firearms. Number two, impact. Funds in this category consider ESG factors, evaluating company stocks not just for their potential returns, but for their impact on society and the environment. For example, they might prioritize companies that have strong sustainability practices or positive community engagement. These funds consider ESG factors above and beyond fund returns. Number three, opportunistic. While these funds also consider ESG factors, they do so only to improve their assessment of a company's risk factors and/or its potential return. As a result, these funds may invest in companies with lower ESG ratings if they believe they will deliver higher returns. The researchers found that only 20% of funds using ESG terminology genuinely qualify as impact funds that prioritize non-financial ESG goals, while the majority fall into the other categories. The ambiguity in terminology used by so-called ESG funds could potentially mislead investors who believe they are supporting funds with a mandate to select holdings aligned with ESG principles, Abyss said. The challenge lies not just in how funds are labeled, but in the very meanings we attach to those labels, she added. Without clear definitions, a fund claiming to focus on ESG might be interpreted in countless ways, leading investors to believe they are supporting impact-oriented initiatives when they might not be. ESG investing has experienced a surge in popularity over the past decade, significantly increasing the assets managed by these funds. ESG funds, meaning any funds mentioning ESG terminology in their prospectuses, represented about 4% of the total number of active equity mutual funds in 2015, managing less than 2% of the capital invested in this industry, according to the paper. After only 7 years, ESG funds grew by a factor of 5, representing 22% of active equity mutual funds and managing almost 20% of the invested capital. However, the portion of capital managed by impact funds, those preferring companies with a better societal and/or environmental impact, has dwindled from 40% of the assets managed by funds mentioning ESG terminology in their prospectuses in 2015 to just 6% in 2022, according to the researchers. The majority of new ESG funds are now classified as opportunistic, indicating a more flexible approach, or as mention-only funds, which often begin as traditional non-ESG funds and later incorporate ESG considerations into their investment processes. This contrast highlights a key challenge. When we hear about a surge in ESG investment, we might mistakenly believe it's all about saving the planet. In reality, many funds are simply integrating ESG factors for risk management rather than pursuing a dedicated impact agenda, Abyss said. In recent years, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has been developing regulations aimed at increasing transparency regarding ESG claims made by investment funds. These efforts include clearly defining ESG fund and ensuring that funds accurately communicate their investment strategies related to environmental, social, and governance factors. Despite this progress toward greater clarity and standardization, Abyss said increased scrutiny around how ESG investing is defined and delivered is still necessary. Even with clear regulations, if funds do not adopt standardized practices for measuring ESG impact, accountability will remain a significant issue, she said. She added that responsibility also falls on investors, who often overlooked fund prospectuses, which contain crucial information about how a fund approaches ESG. By taking the time to understand a fund's narrative and look beyond superficial labels, she said, investors can empower themselves to make more informed decisions. Our next article is titled, Meta Replaces Fact-Checking with X-Style Community Notes, dated January 7, 2025. Facebook and Instagram owner Meta said Tuesday it's scrapping its third-party fact-checking program and replacing it with a community notes program written by users similar to the model used by Elon Musk's social media platform X. Starting in the U.S., Meta will end its fact-checking program with independent third parties. The company said it decided to end the program because expert fact-checkers had their own biases and too much content ended up being fact-checked. Instead, it will pivot to a community notes model that uses crowdsourced fact-checking contributions from users. We've seen this approach work on X, where they empower their community to decide when posts are potentially misleading and need more content, Meta's Chief Global Affairs Officer Joel Kaplan said in a blog post. The Associated Press had participated in Meta's fact-checking program previously, but ended its participation a year ago. The social media company also said it plans to allow more speech by lifting some restrictions on some topics that are part of mainstream discussion in order to focus on illegal and high-severity violations like terrorism, child sexual exploitation, and drugs. Meta said that its approach of building complex systems to manage content on its platforms has gone too far and has made too many mistakes by censoring too much content. CEO Mark Zuckerberg acknowledged that the changes are in part sparked by political events, including Donald Trump's presidential election victory. The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point toward once again prioritizing speech, Zuckerberg said in an online video. Meta's quasi-independent oversight board, which was set up to act as a referee on controversial content decisions, said it welcomed the changes and looked forward to working with the company to understand the changes in greater detail, ensuring its new approach can be as effective and speech-friendly as possible. Our next article is titled, Safeway Contract Negotiations Extended to January 24. Union leaders expect to continue the bargaining process with Safeway and Albertsons executives through Saturday night, dated January 4, 2025. Saturday marked another day of nonstop bargaining between Safeway workers, represented by leaders of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7, and company executives. "We remain far apart, even though we're due to expire at 12:01 tomorrow morning," said Union President Kim Cordova when she spoke to Denver 7 Saturday afternoon. UFCW 7 agreed to a two-week contract extension with King Soopers executives as bargaining for those contracts continues. Bargaining is now set to continue until the new deadline of January 16. In 2022, Kroger and Albertsons announced an agreement to merge. However, U.S. District Court Judge Adrian Nelson issued a preliminary injunction blocking the merger last month following a three-week hearing in Portland, Oregon. Then-Judge Marshall Ferguson in Seattle issued a permanent injunction barring the merger in Washington after concluding it would lessen competition in the state and violate Washington's consumer protection laws. Albertsons filed a lawsuit against Kroger, alleging it didn't do enough to secure regulatory approval for the $24.6 billion agreement. Cordova told Denver 7 that the failed Kroger-Albertsons merger came at consumers' expense, leading to long lines and empty shelves. "Our members have suffered significant reductions in hours and staffing in their store to pay for what's now a failed merger," she said. Union leaders expect to continue negotiating with company executives through Saturday night. They could reach a deal to extend contracts with union leaders, much like what happened with King Soopers on Friday. Safeway union workers' contracts in Wyoming and along the Western Slope will not expire until February. However, on the Front Range, where the vast majority work, contracts will expire at 12:01 a.m. Sunday. That means Safeway union workers in the greater Denver area could go on strike in the next few days. "The soonest we could strike would be once we have a vote. We could vote as soon as Sunday if we wanted to. It really depends on what kind of progress we see today," said Cordova. Albertsons, the parent company of Safeway, said it is in negotiations with the union and did not have further comment. This has been Colorado Business Digest, narrated by Michael Hesser.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.